Hello.
And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm still Tequila Mockingbird.
And I'm still Clay, and I'm so sorry.
And we're still talking about the Skies of Pern. And it's frankly a good thing that this is the last full-length novel, because we've lost the ability to talk about the full-length novels in a reasonable framework of time.
Yeah, one of the problems is that there's two separate threads of stuff going on in this. And the other problem is that the last, well, Master Harper, we were just all over the place. That's on us. But Dragon's Eye and Skies of Pern both, I think, justify their double episodes in the same way that Dragon's Daw did. With there's just so much going on. And it's making so many changes to things, right? So in the early episodes, we could coast on some of the world building stuff because we'd already done the world building episode. You could just listen to that and know where we're coming from. But now we have to talk about how everything is different from the world building episode. So
there you go.
I think we're justified.
We're doing great.
One of the potential, anyway, follow-ups from the feline attack is the in-text follow-up from the feline attack, which is the book's treatment of disability. Ty and Xaranth, as I mentioned, are both somewhat injured, and Felesin and Golanth are both seriously injured in the feline attack.
They're not sure that they will live. They're very dubious that Golanth will be able to see or will be able to fly again.
Yeah, and it's not clear whether Felesin will ever recover full or even really significant use of his injured leg.
Because he's just missing a big chunk of muscle.
Yeah, so one of the things that's interesting is the negotiation of recovery. We spend a bunch of time with characters who are like, we have to convince both Felesin that Golanth is going to be fine, and Golanth that Felesin is going to be fine. Because if Golanth thinks Felesin is going to die, he might go between prematurely. That's something we've been told happens in other books. If a rider is seriously injured, the dragon may panic. Meanwhile, Felesin believing that Golanth is going to be fine will help Golanth be calmer because it will make Felesin calmer. And if both of them are calm, Golanth's recovery will go more smoothly and Felesin will be able to take the time that he needs rather than feeling like he has to be rushing and panicking.
There's an interesting thread there where both this book is celebrating the technological advancements in medical technology, where they talk about the fact that, like, hey, if they hadn't happened to be researching how to deal with abdominal wounds surgically, then it's unlikely that Felesin would have survived his internal injuries. But also the privileging of dragon rider intuition and personal experience over medical expertise, in the sense that they've sewn Galanth's injured eye closed to give the membranes time to heal, but he's able to telepathically communicate to Felesin that it's itching and he wants it off. So Felesin sneaks down in the middle of the night and cuts the stitches out without talking to a healer. And that's narratively presented as the right decision to make.
Or at least as not the wrong decision to make. The healers weren't necessarily wrong, but Felesin is also not wrong. It's just a different approach, and Felesin's maybe more responsive to what Golanth feels.
But as someone who's had stitches,
yeah,
they're itchy. And sometimes the answer is not to remove them.
Yeah.
Because there's also the way that Ty's instinct whenever she's injured, both in an early Abominator attack where she gets beaten badly trying to prevent them from destroying the Healercraft Hall in Landing, and after this, is to go into the ocean. She feels very firmly that salt water is healing. I'm not sure that I agree.
Everyone knows salt water is healing. You have a cut, you go in the ocean, and it helps it heal.
And all that algae is great for you. Yeah. My understanding is that ocean water is not actually great for open wounds, but I'm not a doctor.
I also grew up knowing that salt water is good for you. So I'm with Ty on this.
Really? Well, who can say? So she does that, but it's always met with pushback. Initially, Felesin's like, hey, what are you doing? Get out of the water. You've washed off all your numbweed. And then the healers, she's sneaking out and they're like, what are you doing? And yet again, narratively, it's very much presented as Ty is correct. This is what you should be doing. So I just think there's an interesting tension there. Yes, this high tech healing is great and we respect the Healercraft Hall and it's terrible that they're being attacked by the Abominators.
Yeah.
But also individually, you should tell your doctor to go fuck themselves if you disagree with their medical decisions.
Again, it's the commitment to homeopathic remedies on Pern. Right?
Yeah.
The medical advances are good insofar as the medical advances are making it possible for them to deal with conditions that they wouldn't have been able to previously. Cancers, any kind of internal medicine, serious wounds that involve surgery. There's some back and forth about stitching. And it's like, well, we've been doing that for at least 200 years. I'm like, only 200 years?
When did you spontaneously, halfway through the long interval, realize that stitching wounds was a good idea?
Yeah, that was a little weird. So there's a tension between, obviously, you need scientific medicine for serious things, but if it's some bruises and cuts, go for a swim. That's fine. Put some numbweed on that. You're all good.
Yeah.
Although we are interestingly told, one of the healers is like, even if you have numbweed, you can still hurt yourself because you can't feel that you are hurting yourself.
And I did really appreciate that, because that's very true and a serious issue with a lot of people who have a limited sensation in some part of their body or lose sensation in part of their body.
Yeah.
So it was cool to see that show up. Numbweed is great, but it's not actually fixing anything.
Well, it maybe is fixing things, but it's not instantly fixing things. It is also implied at some points that numbweed, in addition to having the numbing effect, has some kind of healing effect as well, just not in any kind of specific way.
Interesting.
We've talked extensively about ableism in these books, and in particular, how truly horrible they are about any kind of intellectual or developmental disability. She's been better, typically, about physical disabilities, and I think this is maybe one of the best portrayals of a physical disability in the series, because it is something that, unlike Menelie or even unlike Redis, who we see mainly
post-recovery,
after the point where he has recovered as much as he's going to and has the assistive technologies that he needs, namely a runner to help him move long distances that would be too tiring for him.
Yeah.
But who fundamentally can walk fine for his day-to-day needs. He can swim, most importantly, without a problem. And it's not clear that either of those things will ever be the case for Felesin. It sounds like they think he's probably always going to need a cane and or someone to help him walk.
I agree that I think it's a really solid portrayal. I think we see that this isn't easy for Felesin, but that he's also fundamentally optimistic about the future. The most concern that he feels is about the future of mating flights and flying Thread.
Yeah.
The realization that he will not realistically ever be able to fight Thread again is one that's really tough for him and for Galanth. I feel like the narrative is pretty clear on that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's possible that with telekinetic support, either from other dragons or just with him and maybe Xeranth to fly functionally independently, he might be able to do regular flying and possibly even a mating flight, but combat flying is just not a good idea.
Yeah, he's not fully blind in one eye, but his field of vision is significantly limited in one eye. And he won't be able to do the kind of precision flying that you need to do during Threadfall, even if he is able to fly normally in other cases where specific precise vision is less important, which presumably would include a mating flight, especially if you and your partner have arranged it so that it's just the two of you.
And I thought that was brave narratively, and I really appreciated that. I did have some maybe lingering reservation about the way that prior to this happening, there had been this narrative, oh, but he's a bronze dragon rider and he's throwing himself away on a green dragon. Mm. Is that really going to be the end game here? And then there felt like maybe a little bit of the narrative evening of the scales. Honestly, it reminded me of the end of Jane Eyre, where it's like, it's fine that she's poor because now he's blind and has the hand injury. So they're equal. Mm. And it's like, that's not a great vibe.
Yeah, something that comes up repeatedly in the book is characters, most notably Lessa, looking at Ty and being like, huh, really?
A green rider? Okay.
Yeah, and eventually, to their credit, coming to the conclusion, oh, yeah, actually, Ty's great. But there is this question, and I feel like it probably is at least partly connected to the fact that green riders are typically gay men. And so the idea of Felesin settling down with a green rider is still registering to some people as like, but Felesin's a straight guy, and green riders are slutty gay men.
Well, we've even had previously textually from Felesin this idea that practicing with green dragons is cheating for the real challenge that is a gold dragon's mating flight.
Yeah.
So I think I would have really liked it if that had been more directly addressed. Felesin maybe thinking about that, if there had been a little more of the like, oh, actually, no. But they didn't have time for that in this 450-page book.
Yeah, there's too much other stuff going on. It's only 434 pages in my edition. So.
Oh, mine's 456. Exactly. I did also appreciate that there is a beat where Felesin has this renewed respect for Lytol.
Yes, finally Lytol gets his due.
Yeah, Other people have pointed out that, wow, that was really tough or like, hard to keep going. But the only other dragonless character we see is this horrific, like, well, he's a dragonless man, so he doesn't care anymore. He's just murdering people and obeying Thella. It's in Renegades of Pern, and it was a really unsympathetic portrayal. So it was nice to have a little vindication for Lytol of the, like, yeah, his entire life was destroyed, and he very deliberately made the choice to rebuild it and keep going and raise Jaxum and help Ruatha and come to Kofold and reinvent his life again. That takes a lot of courage. And I do appreciate it because I feel like at other points in the series, and we've talked about this, there's sort of a privileging of suicide or of suicidality that leaves a pretty bad taste in my mouth of the, well, if you're not sad enough to die about it, get over yourself attitude when it comes to grief and loss.
Here's the passage where Felessen is thinking about Lytol. Abruptly, another revelation occurred to him. Lytol, with his scarred and seamed face. He had been dragonless for turns, ever since his brown Larth had died in a routine training flight at Benden, a training flight during which Urgul had allowed his dragon a chance to chew Firestone and Flame. Only Larth had caught Flame in the face, and so had Lytol. The dragon had managed to land his gravely wounded rider with the last breath in him. That should have been the end of the rider as a person, a dragonless man. Tradition said dragonless riders suicided rather than live without their dragon, but Lytol had defied that convention and had become far more than a dragon rider. He had been a lord holder for Jackson's minority. He had then turned his hand to help Master Robinton and Duram to manage landing as a major hold to the satisfaction of everyone involved. Now Lytol and Duram, in addition to bearing Blind Wanzer company, had accepted yet another role for which they were unusually qualified, as wise consultants for the complex society of the planet. Briefly, Felessen wondered, even as his soul cringed at the thought, would he have had the courage to build a new life? Lives, in fact, as Lytol had done, if Golanth had succumbed to his injuries. Felessen gave a snort of disgust for his self-absorption, the time he had wasted. As Ty had said, there would be a way. Lytol had made several, and the example of the man's quiet heroism rebuked him. Yeah, Lytol did fully reinvent himself several times in the face of this incredible tragedy. And that is amazing. That was one of the most satisfying moments in the whole book for me, frankly.
Yeah, justice for Lytol.
I hadn't even fully thought about it previously. And then Felessen did this and I was like, oh my god, yeah, everyone has been selling Lytol short for the fact that he radically remade himself. It's good.
And it's a very satisfying ending. I mean, we've talked about this before. The woman knows how to write an ending.
Yeah, even some of the stuff before the ending, as they're coming to terms with this, and there's this moment where all of the dragon riders who have been plotting this, someone suggests it, and they all kind of sit there and are like, whoa, we have a future again. And I'm sitting there, my hand over my heart, like, I get it, they do have a future again, this is amazing. And that's not even the end of the book, which is even more satisfying. So speaking of social transformation and self-reinvention, we haven't talked really about the Abominator's plot.
That's why we needed a whole other episode.
Yeah, which isn't because it's not worth talking about. Despite the fact that it's a bit anticlimactic, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on here. I alluded to this in our 90s retrospective, is some of the historical resonances. I think in particular, one of the things that jumped out at me is the fact that when they're criticizing the Abominators, the way that that's framed is around choice. The idea that the Abominators are attempting to deny people the ability to make an informed choice about what kinds of technologies they want in their lives. To me, especially in a book that's coming right out of the 90s, that reads as extremely about anti-abortion violence and right-wing Christian violence in the US in the 90s.
Yeah.
That this is meant to be a kind of vindication of science and a vindication of progress, quote-unquote, against the Abominators as this deeply reactionary force.
I also think that framing is in contrast with a lot of the usual or the common framing around technological advancement in science fiction, which I thought was fun because it doesn't feel cyberpunk. We are very much not in that realm. And we're very much thinking about these technologies as a communal technology rather than an individual technology, which I think is fun. First of all, because a lot of these are very low technology as things go. We're talking about the idea of surgery and a printing press and shatter-resistant glass rather than the computer that you put in your brain.
Yeah.
But we do see that within the abominators, a big category, there's a lot of different types of objection or a lot of different feelings where some of them are just, I don't think this is real. I think it's a lie or a trick.
Yeah.
Some of it are, I think it's real and I think that it's bad. I think any kind of progress is bad. It should just all stay exactly the same, including thread is actually good, which I'm just like baffled.
Yeah.
Some of them have been lied to, so have like an incorrect understanding of what's going on, are being told like, oh, surgery is just cutting people up for fun. That's going to happen. And some of them are deliberately manipulating this political unrest because they see a profit advantage. I don't think Torek is actually worried about technology.
Yeah.
He just thinks it's a useful political tool. We, yes, see the variety, but also all of those abominators are treated exactly the same way, both diegetically and extra diegetically. There's no, hey, maybe we could educate these people who genuinely are being preyed upon and are just ignorant of what's actually happening.
Well, there is that, because one of the things that's going on in this book in particular is when they're trying to locate the abominators physically, they do this by tracking runner messages, basically, and they're able to identify the abominators are mainly living among the quote-unquote hill folk in Karun, who live in relatively isolated communities and who have historically been anti-education and anti-Harpers, and so have not either been informed adequately about new developments or have
fallen prey to misinformation,
rejected that information and fallen prey to misinformation. Yeah. Part of that is there's a certain amount of, those stupid rural people who are just naturally conservative. But also one of the things that they're grappling with is how do we communicate effectively with these people who have been underserved? One of the things that they identify as a concern of the abominators is that some people are not necessarily opposed to these technologies, but are not convinced that these technologies are actually going to be accessible to them and that they're just going to make the lords more powerful, which is a real and legitimate concern. Certainly that's what Torek is interested in, is the way that the technologies that he thinks can be useful to him will make him personally more powerful. The problem is that the book then throws that concern away and doesn't deal with it anymore. But it is present.
They say that, but all of the abominators get exiled exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And also have their rights violated. That's fine.
Oh my god. In a very normal for Pern way, the abominators say, we have rights. And Lord Grogi says verbatim, you just lost them. What? What do you mean by that? Anyway, I think one of the things that we've talked about in the past is the extent to which Pern is moving towards a kind of liberal bourgeois revolution as industrialization advances, as these new technologies get deployed. And one of the things that we're seeing here is there's kind of two strands among the abominators. One is people like Torek, who are opposed to IVIS technologies because they're concerned about it limiting their own power. Certainly that was what was going on with the first group of abominators, Norist, Sigamal, etc. But Torek is like, I've been cheated of my rightful things by everyone. So now I'm being evil out of spite because I want the money and the land and the power that I feel like I deserve. The more technologies are democratizing things, the less ability I have to exert control over my holders. And in part, one of the things I think he's concerned about, although it doesn't, I don't think, quite go into detail about this, is the same thing that we talked about before. If there's no more thread,
why do you need a Lord Holder?
Then he has nothing to offer his holders, right? He's no longer in charge of shelter. And then on the other hand, you have people like the Hillfolk who have either been misled or are conservative rural voters who are opposed to social change or concerned about social change because it disrupts their way of life. And that's a real phenomenon that she's identified.
I was curious about how that might be read very differently in 2001 than I'm reading it in 2025, especially this idea of it's okay, we've solved the problem of misinformation because now we have printed material.
Yeah.
And I'm like, while you still have a monopoly on printed material, that definitely means that all of the printed material will be material that the printer's craft hall agrees with.
Yeah.
So I would be very curious about how much the early internet was influencing McCaffrey's thoughts on the dissemination of information here and of true information versus rumor.
Well, meanwhile, I'm also thinking about to what extent the 2000 election was influencing how she was thinking about demographics and social variation.
She was pretty involved with online fan forums, at least.
Yeah, and I will note that the dust jacket for this book from 2001 does say, visit the author online at www.annemccaffrey.org. So she was
an early adopter
thinking about the internet. She's kind of written herself into a corner where she can't actually have them have anything like the internet because
she was writing about the space future in the 80s.
She already set the technology level in Dragon's Dawn. So in terms of internal social variation, we do get a fun and extremely perplexing passing comment. In addition to the hill folk in Karoon, one of the other places that they are speculating that the Abominators might be is with the quote unquote desert nomads in Igen. I'm sorry, who?
You know, the desert nomads. They just haven't come up in any of the previous books. Like the dolphins. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, we know that there are some itinerant populations on Pern. It's mainly been the traders so far. We know from the beginning of Renegades that that has been
complicated.
Because it's a logistical problem for both travelers and also for dragon riders, right? What do you do if a caravan is caught out during Threadfall? Dragons catch most thread, but they don't catch all thread, even when they know what the boundaries they're supposed to be protecting are. That's a big question mark for me here. Okay, there's desert nomads in Igen. Are they following established routes? Do they have established shelters that the dragon riders are protecting? What? What is this? Who are they?
How does that work?
And then the other question, since it was, as we discussed in Dragon's Dawn, pretty much stated that all of the quote-unquote ethnic nomads died in the first Threadfall, are these new people who over the past 2,500 years have adopted an itinerant lifestyle in Igen? Are these maybe another group of Tuareg who survived the first Threadfall? Where did these people come from? What's the deal?
Throwaway comment.
And we don't get any information about this other than that they apparently exist.
Along with the Western continent.
Oh yeah, and the far Western continent. I know that it becomes extremely important in the Todd books.
Oh, but we don't read those.
Yeah, so there's a Western continent and they're going to set up an observatory there.
Not the desert nomads of Igen, but I did appreciate seeing social variation in other ways and the degree to which Pern is not a unified society and is not a society that agrees about everything in a way that I think does make it feel very real and very lived in. Frankly, I would have appreciated a little less mob violence because whenever the Abominators get caught, they throw it to the populace who are always unanimously like, just murder them extrajudicially. Quick, do it right now. I'm totally fine with this.
Yeah.
En masse.
And Tun Jaxum and Tagatarl have to be like, no, no, no. We will not summarily execute them now. We will just sentence them to exile where they will die of Threadfall or disease or natural disasters.
As the universe intended.
Yeah.
Not better, folks.
So we've been thinking since Dragon's Eye about the question of citizenship and whether it exists on Pern and what it entails. And one of the things that comes up repeatedly in this book is a question of jurisdiction over individual criminals.
Who gets to murder and or exile them?
Yeah, or sentence to death by hard labor. One of the questions that comes up at the very beginning of the book is a group of Abominators have attacked a bunch of healer halls around Pern, including the healer hall at Fort. Oldive and Shara are there. Oldive is in shock a little bit, I would say, based on the description here.
Yeah, he's also elderly and not in the best health.
Yeah, Lord Grogi shows up once he gets word that this has happened, and Lord Grogi essentially asserts his legal jurisdiction over the criminals.
Here, Shara tells Oldive that he has to go sit down, he's not dressed for the weather, this has been a terrible shock to you, and no, I must stay, it is my hall they have defiled. Oldive asserts that he needs to stay and observe. The discussion continues. It goes back and forth. Then Grogi is talking with Natan and his son about what's happened and the situation. And then he says, take B into the small room. Natan Seabell will question him there. Will you attend, Master Oldive? So not will you be in charge, but will you participate? Oldive says, I must oversee. The healer waved vaguely at the hall. Grogi says, yes, yes, of course. You've better things to do with your time. And then they just fully move into Grogi's in charge. He's going to manage this. And he says, I shall deal with that rabble to the full extent of my power as Lord Holder.
Yeah, although you know what? It does occur to me there that it's Grogi and Tun and Siebel. So they have a Lord Holder, a Master Craftsman, and a Weirleader.
Right. So there's no explicit discussion of, hey, should this be the Healer Hall? But I think it's fair to say that Oldive is clearly not stepping forward and saying, yeah, the Healer Craft Hall will deal with this.
Yeah.
And neither is Shara, who might also have a social right to do that by virtue of being both a healer, either master or journey woman at this point, and the wife of a Lord Holder.
Well, yeah, since question mark, can she vote at Conclave? We'll get back to that question.
So I think it's fair to say that Grogi ends up with jurisdiction, but also nobody else wanted it.
Yeah, that seems fair.
And he does have the quorum of a Weirleader, a Craftmaster, and a Lord Holder on the spot.
Yeah, I guess we take that to mean that they have effectively granted Grogi legal jurisdiction to deal with this specific group, in part maybe because there are groups in a bunch of other holds. Rather than dealing with everyone collectively, Grogi can deal with the ones at Fort and right. Taronis can deal with the ones at Benden, etc.
This isn't going to be a single response.
Yeah.
And there is also some discussion of the fact that they don't know which hall these abominators are from or which hold, and they are refusing to say.
Yeah. And that comes up much more clearly in the second attack on the printer hall, which is foiled, during which essentially Menelik arranges for Jaxum and Anton to show up there. And then once again, we have a Lord Holder, a Weirleader, and a Craftmaster, Tagatarl being the master printer. So legally speaking, they have everything that they need in order to make these decisions, but much more explicitly,
they question whether actually Lord Cashman, the Lord Holder of Karun, should have jurisdiction here. Shouldn't we send for Lord Cashman? Someone shouted from the crowd. He's our holder, and he's supposed to deal with peacebreakers, thieves, burglars, and such. For general hold matters, Pinch said quickly, and Pinch is Master McElroy, the Harper who is in charge of the spy situation here.
Yeah.
This is a Harper Hall matter. However, if any of you, and he addressed the captives, is from this hold, you may step forward, and I'm sure Lord Cashman will keep you comfortably enough. They don't respond. As I was saying, Pinch continued with a faint grin, if you are of this hold, you can be transferred to the hold to await Lord Cashman's judgment. None of the captives claimed that right. Name, hold, hall, and rank, if any, Natan said, stepping with authority beside Pinch. There was no response, and Natan shrugged. Then, since they have been caught in an illegal entry and in the willful destruction of an authorized craft hall, Master Tagatarl, Master McElroy, how will you deal with them?
Yeah.
So they are explicitly setting aside the possibility that the Lord Holder of Karun should have authority above their own since they're under his auspices here in Karun.
Well, and in fact, possibly that not just the Lord Holder of Karun, but that another holder or craftmaster, if anyone claimed affiliation with another Lord Holder or craftmaster, might have jurisdiction over them, or at least would have jurisdiction to speak on their behalf. Which is something that seems like it might have been relevant for the trial in All the Weirs of Pern, that lords are supposed to be able to speak as legal advocates, or are supposed to have legal jurisdiction over or legal responsibility for. Again, the question of to what extent holders are free or have freedom of movement versus whether they are in some way the property or dependents of their lords.
And Lord Cashman is very upset about this.
Yeah, he feels that at the very least, Jaxum has usurped his right, that he should have been the Lord Holder who was called in to adjudicate, and possibly that the three of them collectively usurped his right, and this should have entirely been an internal Karun matter, and then has to have it pointed out that it did involve Karun, it involved the printer craft, which is autonomous, ostensibly.
Maybe his first argument has more weight than his second one,
yeah.
Because when we do see Lord Grogi is involved, but it also happened in Fort.
Yeah. Whereas basically Jaxum and Tun are like,
Medley's Fire Lizard happened to be here and happened to notice something and happened to let us know.
Yeah, so it's very obviously contrived. I don't blame Cashman for being a little bit like, bro.
This feels shady.
Because it was.
Yeah, all of the problems that we have previously discussed around Hearn's quote-unquote justice system are back in full force.
Yeah.
We love to exile people. If we haven't exiled anybody, we just don't think our day is any good.
Yeah, the other aspect of this is the question of autonomy, because it seems like autonomy might be on the way out. Something that we have suspected and have seen the
harbingers.
Yeah, the signs of in previous books as well. And here it is most apparent in the council scene. Lord Sangal of Southbowl
has finally died.
He's finally died. He's been the oldest lord for a very long time. He was already old in Dragonflight, and this is 35 years later.
He was already old in Master Harper, wasn't he? They were trying to convince him to deal with facts, and he was like, whatever.
That's true, yeah. So Sangal is really old, and for the last while, his wife Morella and his granddaughter Janissian, who was his steward, have been managing the hold by themselves for all intents and purposes.
There are two male relatives who could hypothetically inherit. One of them is his great nephew, and one of them is his first cousin.
Yeah.
The great nephew has very much disqualified himself because when the tsunami happened, he panicked and ran and didn't take care of anyone else, refused to help manage the evacuation. So he's pretty clearly unfit.
Yeah.
The other one's just not politically ambitious, basically.
Yeah.
His children have worked for the hold, but he hasn't. So they're like, hey, if he doesn't want it, then we're not giving it to him for nothing.
Right. If he wanted it, he'd be here now contending, and he isn't.
Yeah.
But there is some debate about whether Janissian, because she's a woman, can be Lady Holder. And they're like, well, Emily Bull was Holder in her own right.
Don't know that she was.
I don't think that happened. I think she was dead. I think it was Pierre de Courcy who was Holder. But anyway, setting that aside, crucially, in contrast to all the Weirs of Pern, where we had some extremely perplexing voting that we were trying to track the numbers of, and none of them lined up with the number of Lord Holders who were there, now we maybe have an answer for why that was. Because when the votes are cast, even though there are only 16, 17 major holds, there are 45 votes cast in this council. So who's voting? The answer appears to be not just all the Lord Holders, but also all of the Weir leaders, several but not all Weir women, because some of them are not particularly politically involved, and a number of, but not all, craftmasters.
Which is fascinating.
Especially because, ostensibly, it's only been 2 years since all the Weirs of Pern, which means that they have radically reworked the way their planetary government works.
With no discussion or announcement.
Yeah, so this implies that they have done away with the concept of autonomy. Now, I think there are also good reasons to think that this is not actually 2 years after all the Weirs of Pern. I think that timeline does not make sense.
Well, remember, there are Ivis-adjusted years, so who knows when anything is happening.
Maybe, yeah, that's probably why. That would explain a lot of the confusion. We'll maybe talk briefly about some continuity errors at the end of the episode, and they're fun. But this means that holds are no longer autonomous, in the sense that holds, crafts, and Weirs are no longer
discrete entities,
independent, yeah, but in interacting political systems. Yeah, if everyone, and not just the other Lord Holders, has a say in who becomes Holder at Bol, which is really interesting and makes sense.
But I do think that we saw the first step of this when the Dragon Riders, the Weirs, were asked to take over authority on distributing land claims in Southern, because that's a hold question.
Yeah, well, and when landing was given to Lightall, Duram, and Robinton to manage collectively, that implies a collective government involving all three groups rather than each group operating independently or semi-independently.
And they do make a point of stating in this book that even though Robinton has passed, Wanzer is now living there. So there's still like a craft representative in that covehold.
Yeah, although it sounds like it's Esalen and Aragon who are the ones who are actually managing landing.
And I think that's interesting in what it suggests about the future of Pern.
Yeah.
Because to your point, there's a degree to which the Lord Holders themselves are becoming obsolete alongside the Dragon Riders.
Yeah.
And as the Dragon Riders are transitioning into a craft instead of a separate thing, they're not going to be receiving tithes anymore. They're going to be the Starcraft Hall.
Yeah.
As opposed to just the Dragon Riders. That maybe suggests an interesting potential future of Pern where it's all just crafts.
Yeah.
I don't hate it.
Pern might not have a violent bourgeois revolution, but we're definitely moving towards a situation where merchants, businessmen, industrial leaders, etc., are the driving power on Pern, and landowners are not, because there's enough land that we're now going to be back in a situation in 16 years where people can just go somewhere else. And there will be a legal process for distributing that, but it's also going to be managed by people who are in charge of a craft, who are themselves going to be entering into a skilled trade and making money that way.
One, are we just pushing that down the pike? Because that's how Dragonstone started too. There's so much land. We don't need to worry about this. Everyone just gets land and it's fine. And yeah, that solves the problem for 100 years, even 1,000 years. But eventually, even the southern and apparently western continents will run out.
Yeah.
But also, we do get some more hints about holders in this same conclave scene, because they're talking about the fact that, well, Janissian, she's competent and she's of the blood. And Lessa's kind of sarcastic about it. She's like, isn't it a good thing that Janissian happens to be well qualified?
because she's also literally the only blood relative they can find. And Filar says, Hold Blood's getting thin after 2,500 turns. And with the end of Threadfall, Filar murmured, Holding began with Fort with Paul Bendon. There's nothing wrong with Fort's bloodline. But that form of inheritance is not in the charter, you know. Filar regarded her in mild surprise. No, actually, it isn't. Holders and all those traditions came later. And that's very interesting.
Okay, so there's a couple problems here continuity-wise. One, Paul Bendon was the first Lord Holder at Fort, but he was not succeeded by his child. He was succeeded by Joel Lilienkamp. We know that from Chronicles of Pern.
So that might be historical confusion.
Yeah. Second, we know from all the Weirs of Pern that even if the rights and privileges of Lord Holders are not in the charter, blood inheritance is in the charter. And in fact, that every land grant per the charter is supposed to be entailed. So it's not supposed to be able to pass outside of a family. We're explicitly told that in all the Weirs of Pern. So the question that is Filar implying that even though we know Grogi and many other lords have bazillions of children and grandchildren, that eventually the holder bloodlines are going to die out and the land will just, I guess, maybe devolve to the people who actually work it? Is there a mechanism for that in the charter? Who knows?
Because we haven't yet run into the problem of there's genuinely no one of the blood available. Even with Fax, it was able to be like, no, it's okay. We found the long lost second cousin who was up in the mountains.
That's not true. The one exception is Nabol. But there, it seems to be that they couldn't find anyone of the blood. And by the time they realized that Mirren had already established himself, and they were like, we're not touching that. Fine.
Right.
That's sort of the vibe that I got from anyway. But Mirren was Fax's steward, not of the blood.
And also ontologically evil.
Yeah. But everywhere else, I believe, went to someone who was a distant relative or the younger son in Bargain's case in High Reaches.
Yeah.
So we have questions.
But I also think that is looping back around to the question that we had before, which is the charter that they're talking about just this document that we saw in Dragonstone? And it seems more and more likely that it is.
Because we see them consult the charter in this. It's a physical document.
It has Stev Kimmer's signature on it.
It has Stev Kimmer's physical hand signature on it. Because the reason Felessen is in the archive where he meets Ty for the first time is because Felessen is trying to figure out what happened at Honshu. He has found some things that are inscribed with the initials SK. And has narrowed down the field and concluded that Stev Kimmer is the only person that can be, and he's trying to confirm that the initials that he's found are Kimmer's. And Ty's like, well, have you checked the charter? And Felessen's like, oh my god, it never occurred to me that I could go look at the physical charter that we have with everyone's signatures on it. And he looks at it and is like, oh yeah, I guess it is. That's Kimmer. Which is fascinating because it means that they've had the physical charter buried in the archive at Fort Hold, I guess, for a long time. And the reason that it survived is because we've had references in previous books to Plas film.
And flimsy.
As something that they were using for writing and they were running out of. And based on the description of the charter, Plas film appears to be lamination and not some new plastic material. So I think, based on the description, it sounds like the charter is a piece of paper that all 6,000 colonists apparently signed. Giant piece of paper.
Many pieces of paper, perhaps.
And then they laminated it, and now it's on display at landing. Great. I love lamination.
Love that for them.
That's so 80s.
That means that if you shake the charter, it will make a whoop, 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 whoop sound.
As it should.
That's how you know it's legit.
Yeah. Now, in my head, the charter will forever have the vibe of a fourth grade art project.
Yes.
Laminated construction paper. That's how I'm envisioning the charter now. It's purple.
Yeah. This all feels very natural to me.
In Dragon's Eye, they talk about Lord Holder's rights being in the charter.
What does that mean?
And the question that we had is, does that mean that they've revamped the charter? Or are they just talking about the land inheritance stuff that we already know from all the Weirs of Pern exists? And it seems like they're just talking about the land inheritance stuff that we know from all the Weirs of Pern.
And I do think this suggests that my theory that the Lord Holders are the ones who are descended from charterers versus contractors is borne out.
Yeah.
Because Felessen notes that distinction when he's flipping through the different pages.
I agree. I don't know it's the only reading, but it feels intuitive.
And it does make more sense to me that there would have been something about inherited land clauses written into the charter about these charterers. because they are presumably paying astronomical amounts of money in exchange for land rights on this future planet. And you'd want to be sure that if you trip and die the second you walk off the spaceship, that that doesn't evaporate and your spouse or your children can continue.
Yeah.
Because they are very much seeing this, right, as a colonization project. It seems that more of the charterers are coming with a whole family versus contractors who are just single adults coming by themselves.
Yeah. The other thing that that unfortunately does suggest is that the colony was conceived as having a permanent underclass of people descended from contractors who were always going to have to work off a term of indenture in order to earn their stakes. How does that difference inherit is the question.
Yeah. If they're extrapolating an entire feudal structure out of that and referring back to the charter, it does seem to imply that there is less of that ironclad protection for the stake that a contractor can buy once they're on Pern.
Yeah.
And that might also connect back to what confused us about the Fort of Red Hanrahan and this idea that all of these random other people would be joining their claim to Peter Hanrahan's in order to found Ruatha.
Yeah. So this maybe pivots us to other economic questions. There's some perplexing stuff here. An offhanded comment that the mining facility where Shankelin and company have been doing hard labor, that 20 marks is more than their annual income, which seems baffling because Robinton gave Menely 2 marks to spend on a belt at a gather.
And to be fair, the cost of skilled artisan-made goods is artificially low in our contemporary world. So we might be earmarking that wrong mentally, right? Like a worked leather belt probably would be pretty flippin' valuable. And it's also possible that that mine in specific, since it seemed to function at least partially more as a form of incarceration and punishment than as an actual economic center, doesn't have a super high profit.
Yeah.
Because they have to turn around and pay a bunch of guards and feed people when presumably most mine workers would go home to their own small holding and eat at home, something like that, that might artificially deflate the profit margin of this specific mine.
But still, we know in Dragonsinger, 1/32nd mark gets you 3 bubbly pies. 20 marks is only 1,900 bubbly pies. That doesn't seem right for a year. I don't think so. Something, at the very least, has gone wrong. That's comically low. Even if we assume that their profit margin is lower, that's 5 pies a day.
Okay, yeah, that's too low.
Yeah, I don't think this is a 5 pies a day mining facility.
So there are ways to explain it diegetically, right? We can say that the runner who made this comment, like more than they've earned in turns, was exaggerating for effect or had misunderstood or is trying to artificially inflate the value of the meteorite because he also has a meteorite and he wants to be like, wow, this meteorite is so special. And it wasn't actually all that impressive. Or we can extra diegetically just say, well, McCaffrey messed up her math. I think the latter is more plausible than the former.
Yeah, this points us towards other questions about the way this book is dealing with economics. One is, for example, why is the printer hall at Caroon in the plains, where we know it's mainly the Beastcraft Hall and the hill folk, but all of whom seem to be essentially pastoralists? Why is it there and not, say, in Limo's Hold, where we know there's trees and wood production, because that's where the woodcraft is? Or even in Bitra, where we know forestry is the only non-gambling industry that's ever been mentioned there. On a purely resource distribution perspective, that makes no sense. It's not even like Caroon is particularly centrally located for distributing news.
If I'm an unpaid defense lawyer for Anne McCaffrey's ghost, I could construct plausible reasons, but I would be doing that work. This would be the fake good version of Pern that lives in my head. I might say they didn't want to put a craft hall in Bitra.
Yeah.
Because it sucks to be in Bitra and you can't attract good people.
Yeah, that seems very reasonable.
I could say they didn't want to put 2 new craft halls in the same hold at the same time. If they're starting the wood craft hall and the printer craft hall and the plastic hall, they very deliberately spread those out. So one's at Lemos, one's at Southern, one's at Caroon. You might even say that there was a political, hey, Caroon deserves, East Coast deserves a new craft hall too. And maybe that was some kind of political dealing with trying to pork belly get the craft hall established.
Although then the question is, why not put it at Narat, where there are no craft halls?
Yeah.
Whereas Caroon already has one. The other explanation that occurs to me is that they're doing it intentionally, that the inefficient distribution of artisanal production versus resource extraction is a conscious decision that they are making in order to essentially limit industrialization and
have trade across the continent,
promote interdependence, and make it harder for Lemos Hold to
suddenly become an economic powerhouse. Yeah,
restrict access to all of these new things.
And there might be something. Who was the previous Lord Holder of Karun?
Corman.
And we didn't really like him, right? He was conservative?
Yeah, he was conservative and sympathetic to the Abominators, but not himself an Abominator.
Right.
He was the person that, when we were talking about the unhinged legal proceedings in All the Wears of Prone, we were like, why didn't they just get Corman to speak on their behalf? Because he agrees with them, just didn't participate in the plot.
Well, then that might have been a very pointed decision to put the Printercraft Hall in his hold.
Mm, maybe.
Either as a fuck you to him, or in a very deliberate, okay, we want to make sure that there's someone who has authority in that jurisdiction who's not Lord Corman.
Mm.
Having a craft hall there gives you some weight to like, no, actually, I'm under the auspices of my craft master, not of my Lord Holder.
Yeah.
In a way that might be politically advantageous.
It puts two more progressive crafts there also, because we know that the Beastcraft now is one of the two craft halls that has a female craft master.
Ballora.
They call her the Beastmaster, which I love for her. And the new Master Weaver is also a woman.
So that's possibly a very intentional counterweighting.
Yeah, maybe.
And also, again, this is purely me being an unpaid defense lawyer, but there's a degree to which it's maybe Rasheen's family's from Karun, and she was like, I want to go home. My mom's getting old.
Maybe Tagatarl's from Karun. We don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
That maybe points us towards a broader question of communication and trade and the distribution of anything on Pern, because one of the things this book follows up on is Runner of Pern.
Oh my gosh. None of my questions from Runner of Pern were answered.
They were not.
All of my questions from Runner of Pern are more intense, and I know that they are not going to be answered. And we've really doubled down on the, actually, the runners have been here like the dolphins and the desert nomads of Aigen the whole time, and you just didn't get to know about it. Because there is, and I think I really appreciate this, a point to which the runners are not super enthused about the Printcraft Hall and about the fact that dragons might be carrying messages and conveying cargo at literally instantaneous speeds after the pass ends.
Yeah.
And they're feeling some professional anxiety about that that makes them kind of sympathetic to the Abominators.
Yeah. The runners, on the one hand, are nonviolent, I would say. So they're not actively supporting the Abominators.
Yeah.
And they have been, we're told, taking Abominator pamphlets out of circulation, for example. But when Halligan, Grogi's son, who we met in Runner of Pern, is sent to talk to the runners, because people know that he's involved with Tenna and they have a sympathetic relationship.
And I love the fact that this is, what, 30 years after Runner of Pern takes place?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Which means that they've just been casually hooking up for a couple of decades now. And that's amazing. You go, Tenna. Follow your life plan of not stopping your career for this cute boy.
I mean, honestly, also, you go Halligan, resist the pressures to marry someone and settle down and establish a quote-unquote normal holder life for yourself.
Because I do think they're in their late 40s or early 50s at this point, and they're just making out in alleyways like you do.
Yeah, apparently. Wild.
I think McCaffrey probably had not thought about the amount of time that had elapsed, but I'm choosing to believe that that's a fun, transgressive decision she made on purpose.
It is more fun that way. But I agree, it's almost certainly that she just wasn't thinking about the timeline when she wrote Skies of Pern, because it's a little sketchy.
Mm-hmm.
The runner station master that he talks to, when Halligan is asking, like, can you ask around and find out where these weird messages are coming from? Like, we would appreciate the favor.
Nudge, nudge, wink,
wink. The station master's like, maybe, I'll let you know.
Why would we want to help?
Yeah, and then Halligan has to talk him through it and basically argue, like, no, no, there will always be a need for runners. And this is reiterated later on by Lessa in a conversation when the runners do in fact bring them information. Basically the station master that they're talking to is like, well, I heard some things, but it's kind of like, I need some assurances from you. And Les is like, there have always been runners, there will always be runners, we're never gonna replace runners. Well,
actually,
you have fire lizards, you're working on walkie-talkies, we know, and potentially phone systems,
you're gonna have a bunch of bored dragons,
you're gonna have a bunch of bored dragons, and we know that green riders carry messages even in the ninth pass. That's something we're told now, Ty makes money by killing felines and selling the skins, and also by carrying messages, and sometimes even by conveying passengers, it sounds like. The sort of higher dragon colors don't do that, but greens and blues do. So it actually seems extremely reasonable for runners to be concerned that they're going to be rendered obsolete. And by the end of the book, it seems like that's probably no longer an issue if the idea is that all dragon riders, or at least most dragon riders, and in the future all dragon riders, are going to transition into
astronomers.
But it's a real question early in the book, and the answer is that won't happen.
Yeah, I'm not really sold about that.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at the history. I mean, the Pony Express, right, gets all the press and all the PR because it's so cool. It's so fun. Like, oh, they're riding through the night with the fast message. You know how long the Pony Express lasted?
It's comically short.
2 years, because the year after it was established, they invented the telegraph.
Yeah, which we know that they have on Pern also.
I would feel like a lot more practical reassurance would be pivoting runners into something that maybe is more likely to endure, because what we do also see is that runners are kind of the first newspaper distribution here.
Yeah.
Where they're taking things printed from the printer craft hall and disseminating it, not immediately like a dragon, but you don't need it immediate. You need it in the next 4 or 5 days as a runner moves through your area. And now that they have these printed messages, you don't have to memorize it quite so much. Always, there would have been the function of asking a runner, like, hey, what's going on? What's the news from the bigger city now that you're in a more rural area? But the fact that they can now carry newspapers, I would think making them the mail seems a lot more plausible, because that's kind of what they were already.
Yeah, which is exactly what I was going to say. It feels like the much more plausible explanation to be like, even if dragons are transporting messages from hold to hold.
Urgent messages.
Yeah, there's never going to be enough dragons to do all of that, which is something that I think they maybe vaguely gesture towards, but don't really fully deal with. Even if dragons are doing bulk mail delivery,
mm-hmm.
an individual dragon rider is not going to be popping around to every single small hold in fort to drop off 50 different pieces of mail. You're always going to need a system for local distribution.
Yeah.
In a context where it doesn't seem like they have plans to implement a planet-wide telegraph network or cell phone service, for example. Although who knows, if they have dragons putting satellites in, maybe there'll be satellite phones. But either way, it seems like there's an obvious local need for runners, even if there's less of the we're running across the whole continent. So a significant change, but not an end.
The other question that I had is, we do see at the end of the book a runner arriving on Southern with a bunch of messages. And I'm like, so there's a trace? They put in a trace across Southern? When did they do that?
Yeah.
When did they specifically plant this weird type of moss and allow it to grow and carve out these specific paths to everywhere that they need to go in Southern, which is rapidly being settled? Again, the logistics do not line up for me.
But that should be, if anything, a reassurance to runners. Your craft is growing right now.
If you're actively putting in a trace, yeah.
You are not, in fact, going to be replaced within 2 years, or even within 16 years by the end of the pass.
Yeah. As we've mentioned previously, we are starting to see the hints that Pern, 400 years after the last pass, is going to be a very different place than Pern 400 years before the last pass.
Yeah. One thing that we both had noted, but that you had picked on more, is the portrayal of Ty physically.
Yeah, because unlike, I would say, pretty much every other Ninth Pass character, she seems to be narratively signposted as a specific race. She's East Asian, probably mixed race, because it's pointed out that she has green eyes. But the text specifically goes out of its way to talk about the fact that her eyes have an unusual slant. Both Felesin and Lessa notice this independently. And that her skin has a golden tone.
Yeah.
And especially given Dragon's Dawn and the fact that we know there were a lot of East Asian people on Pern, that does seem to suggest that she is descended from some of them. But it's just interestingly marked when we had been bending over backward to be like, so does this mean that Briala is perhaps Black? We're doing all of this detective work in a way that does seem different from the way Ty is portrayed.
Yeah, I'm sort of back at my little, was Kenjo planning to be the Showa Emperor of Pern? But we're told that the idea was that not just Kenjo's family, that there would be an East Asian community generally at Honshu,
mm-hmm.
that was sort of the idea. So maybe the implication is that at least in some areas, specific ethnic or racial communities did stay grouped together.
The desert nomads of Aigen.
Maybe, yeah. One of the other weird character choices in this is the fact that we have this Harper spy named Pinch, or McElroy, who is a master harper, but just, you know, wanders around doing spy stuff. stuff. And obviously we know that this is a thing that has existed in the Harper craft for a while, because Nip in Master Harper of Pern is also a Master Harper, I believe, but whose job is just to be a spy. The thing that I was grappling with is, why is it not just Nip again? Or, since this is 30 years into the past, why is it not Nip's apprentice, who would be in his mid-40s right now, the appropriate age to be doing this kind of spy work? But it's not. There's a passing reference to Nip and Tuck, his apprentice, and the fact that there are other spies, but I was confused about why she felt she needed to introduce a new character specifically for this.
Especially because she loves to reintroduce old characters.
Yeah, not only are we told that the new Master Weaver is a woman, but she has to specifically name drop, oh yes, Zurg, the old Master Weaver, is dead. I obviously know who Zurg is, but we didn't need the name drop.
Yeah.
In fact, the fact that I know who Zurg is makes me need it less. Like, you could have just said the old Master Weaver had died, and be like,
oh. I'd been like, oh, Zurg.
Too bad. I remember Zurg.
Yeah.
He was in Dragonflight.
But I think that does speak maybe to the next question, which is this question of how old is anybody ever?
Yeah.
And how long has it been since the events of Master Harper and the events of Dragonflight, which are in some way the same time because one ends when the other begins?
Yeah.
Because Menora is here. She's chilling. She's flying from one continent to another. How old is Menora?
Yeah.
Because she was an adult woman and Fëanor's mom 30-something years ago.
When Fëanor was 32 plus 2 years in the past.
And he's now in his 60s? 50?
Apparently. Fëanor is now described as 63 in the 31st year of the pass. So
that would make Fëanor 61.
Well, that would make Fëanor older because of 2 years in the past. But yeah, so assuming that Menora was in her early 20s when he was born.
So she's now in her mid-80s?
I guess. She's not the only person that we were perplexed by. Over the course of the book, Remart of Telgar Weir retires with the Telgar Weir woman, and then the High Reach's Weir leaders, Mirand and Pilgra, also retire. We're told that the only two remaining old-timer Weir leaders are Gnarish of Aigen, who is young and we like him, although he's now old, or older anyway, but he's about the same age as Fëanor and Lessa.
And as we know, when they get old, everyone becomes evil.
And then Gedenned of Ista, who is Duram's son. And Gedenned is described as being 20 years older than Fëanor. Excuse me?
This is fascinating, because when he took over in Ista, he was described as a young, new, up-and-coming.
Yeah.
Wow, Duram's so confident, he just threw it open to any rider, but his son's such a great kid.
And I think we're told, in fact, explicitly, that he was born in the old time, but grew up mainly in the present. That was my impression, anyway. And now, suddenly, he's supposed to be in his 80s? In order for that to be the case, that would mean
Duram is in his hundreds?
Yeah, and on top of that, that would mean that Gedenned, when he was the young new Weir leader, quote-unquote, would have already been
20 years older than Fëanor.
Yeah, so in his 70s?
Pardon?
I don't think so, sorry. Certainly, people in their 70s can still have vigorous sex lives. I don't know that I'm convinced that someone in his 70s is having such a vigorous sex life that hours after the mating flight, while the Weir is in crisis because Robinton is dying and all the dragons on Pern are trying to keep him alive, Salth just died, T'Cull is dead. I don't think that someone in his 70s is having wild sex for 8 hours under those circumstances, oblivious to everything that's going on outside. Sorry, I don't believe that.
And that's very ageist of you, Thay.
Even if he's, you know, a vigorous dragon rider, I don't believe that he would have the energy for that.
All of this, it's all trumped by the fact that Duram is his dad and is still alive.
Yeah, I mean, we know people live longer.
And is visibly not as old as Wanzer.
Yeah, it's all very perplexing. The only in-world explanation that I can think of is that Gedenned was with Jaxum's group going into the past to drop off the engine. And like that one guy who we hear about, mistimed it on his way back and lived 20 turns in the past and then came back to the present, and everyone was like, oh yeah, that's Gedenned, that's fine, he's 20 years older, don't worry about it. But that seems like a stretch, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very perplexing. How old is anyone? Sometimes we don't want to think about it, don't want to know how old Felesin is, because I don't want to know how old he was when he had kids. I do kind of want to know how old Gedenned is,
just for sheer morbid curiosity.
Yeah. What is happening there? Because it suggests a wildly different relationship with age on Pern that I don't feel like is borne out anywhere else in the series.
I think we just need to accept
that we had Ivis adjusted turns. So everyone is 14 years younger or older, because that's definitely how renumbering your years works. And don't worry about it.
You know what? Maybe there were extra turns in the 8th pass, and they miscounted Gadenid's age in the 8th pass as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the issue was. When they adjusted it, on paper he's 50, but actually he's 70. And they just misplaced 20 years in the 8th pass.
Okay.
There we go. I've figured it out. I've connected the dots.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to have to end on that note with a small question. So we do get a casual mention of the ghosts, which are the annual meteor shower that are perceived to be the ghosts of old dragons. And again, this is very much presented as like, as of course you know, as has been happening this whole time.
I think this means that when Lytol and Ivis were having an argument about religion on Pern, that Ivis was going to argue that Pern did not have religion, and Lytol was going to argue that actually Pern did have religion and superstitions, just in a form that Ivis either wasn't yet aware of or didn't understand or didn't perceive as a religion. Because if they believe in ghosts, or if they have a belief in ghosts, even if it's a childish belief,
if they know what ghosts are,
right, that means they have some kind of sense of the supernatural, which is not something we have ever seen previously in the series.
So that's an interesting retcon, and it's possible that it was an intentional groundwork laying for Beyond Between.
Yeah.
Which we are not going to read because it's dumb.
We are going to read it because we're completionists.
Gentle reader, we will be putting up a poll to discuss this topic. And so I guess we'll get there, or we won't. Please tell me we won't.
Stay tuned, because we will.
As we've already mentioned, you really shouldn't read Skies of Pern. Instead, and if you have already read our recommendations from the previous episode, what about these?
My recommendation is a bit of a stretch, frankly, but we're scraping the bottom of the barrel in terms of my ability to come up with books that are connected to Pern after 15 novels and a bunch of short stories. My recommendation is The Gilda Stories by Jewel Gomez, which is a classic Black lesbian vampire novel from the early 90s. If you're interested in books about social change, although in this case over a long haul from the early 19th century up into the future, I think the last section is around 2100, but mid-late 21st century in any case. It's really interested in the development of Black culture in the US and shifting attitudes around race, and also in technological developments in the near future that it imagines. It's also, as one might expect from a vampire novel, although it is a very atypical vampire novel, interested in sexual violence, consent, violence in general. It's not perhaps the most obvious pair with The Skies of Pern, but I think it's a really good book, and it might scratch some of the same itch, depending on what you liked about Skies.
My offering is a little farther afield, but thinking about natural disasters and the way that they have a serious effect on communities, thinking about, too, the stratification of Pernese community and the ways that culture and family are transmitted, I would like to recommend The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom, which is actually nonfiction. It is a memoir of several generations of the author's family history, and specifically centering on the house that her mother owned that was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina. So it's a really beautiful exploration of Black culture in New Orleans, and specifically in New Orleans East, a part of New Orleans that doesn't really achieve a lot of cultural recognition.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates, or to send us questions or comments. And you can find our archive of episodes, along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org.